Yes, it's Bigler's World. Bigler's World for the next hour. Right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And I'm Jim Bigler. Let's do a bunch of different kids' magazines. I got National Geographic Kids Magazine. I don't have any Ranger Rick. Where'd the Ranger Rick go? Huh? Got no Ranger Rick. Got Science News. I'm sorry, Science News for Kids. Let's do a little Dogo News for Kids, huh? Just for the kids. The World Marathon Challenge, a race like none other, says Alvaro Aragon, who wrote this article. Running a single marathon is hard enough for most people. Now imagine doing it seven times on seven continents in less than 168 hours or 7 days. That is exactly what the annual World Marathon Challenge dares participants to accomplish. As if that weren't enough, they also compete for the fastest total time across all seven races. The annual event is limited to just 60, as in 60 athletes, and costs $48,000 per person. This year's challenge, held from January 31st to February 6th of 2025, this already happened, drew participants from 21 countries. The youngest was 18, while the oldest was an impressive 68. The race kicked off in Ultima Base, Antarctica, followed by marathons in Cape Town, that's in Africa, Perth, Australia, Dubai, Asia, Madrid, Europe, Fortaleza, South America, and Miami. Where's that? Oh, North America. I would say the United States, actually. Each leg required participants to complete, there it is, a full 26.2-mile marathon before boarding a plane to the next destination. In total, they traveled over 26,000 miles, crossed 18 time zones, and ran 183.4 miles. Along the way, they faced temperatures ranging from a frigid 5 degrees Fahrenheit in Antarctica to a sweltering 95 degrees in South America. With just 3 hours between landing and running again, the challenge pushed their physical and mental endurance to the limit. The 2025 overall winner was Paul Holborn, a British native who now lives in San Antonio, Texas. He averaged 3 hours, 22 minutes, 36 seconds per marathon, finishing with a total time of 23 hours and 38 minutes. Holborn's achievement is even more remarkable considering he ran his first marathon just 19 months before the event. A former boxer, Holborn had given up exercising at age 27 due to long work hours. Determined to get back into shape, he searched online for the world's toughest endurance events and found the World Marathon Challenge. And he says, "I thought, who on earth can do 7 marathons in 7 days? That's legendary. But I couldn't shake the idea. My wife backed me all the way, and that was it. I threw myself into training," Holborn said. Holborn turned out to be a natural runner. He finished his first marathon in about 3 hours, coming in second. This encouraged him to take on the World Marathon Challenge, which he won despite being one of the least experienced competitors. And this is him talking again. "I kept expecting these guys to overtake me, but I got stronger with each race. I learned so much about myself that week," he said. "At times, it felt impossible. My legs were screaming. My body wanted to shut down. But I refused to quit. I just kept reminding myself this was my moment." Holborn is the first Briton to win the challenge. While thrilled with the victory, he is already looking ahead to new goals. They include attempting a 75-mile ultra-marathon in Scotland and climbing Africa's tallest peak, Mount Kilimanjaro. Next article. Right here on Bigler's World, sticking with Dogo News, prank time. April Fool's Day is almost here. Actually, it is here. Kevi Dolazia wrote this article. For pranksters, no holiday tops April Fool's Day, celebrated annually on April 1st. It is one day of the year when the lighthearted tricks are not just accepted, they are welcomed. The origin of this fun tradition is unclear. Some believe it began in 1582 when the world moved from the Julian calendar, which started the new year around April 1st, to the Gregorian calendar. Others think it began as a way to celebrate the arrival of spring. Regardless of its origin, April Fool's Day is celebrated worldwide. Even companies join in with the elaborate pranks that fool people for hours or even days. Here are a few of our favorite from past years. Virgin Australia's Kids Class Cabin. Couldn't say that. In 2016, Virgin Australia announced the introduction of a Kids Class Cabin. The adult-free zone offered perks like seats designed for kids to easily kick the one in front. Also included, well, aren't they already designed that way? Already included was a special teddy bear to provide comfort. The young passengers could even play hopscotch down the aisles to burn off excessive energy. The only catch? This exciting news was revealed on April Fool's Day. Then there's Bok Shoe by Adidas. Adidas is known for its innovative sneakers, but none were as unusual as the Bok Shoe unveiled in 2024. Shaped like a shoebox, it featured a cutout with a flap forming the opening and tongue, along with thick laces stitched to the top. To make the concept convincing, the company even created a product page on its website. The only clue that it was a hoax, the product code AFO104, a nod to April Fool's Day, April 1st. BBC's Spaghetti Harvest. I wish I'd done this one. The British Broadcasting Corporation, or BBC, was the first television network to stage a prank April 1st in 1957. Its popular current affairs show, Panorama, aired a special segment. It claimed that a mild winter and the eradication of the harmful spaghetti weevil had led to a record spaghetti harvest. The episode featured women joyfully picking long pasta strands from the trees. Many viewers believed the hoax and called in, eager to learn how to grow their own spaghetti trees. They were told to stick a dry piece of pasta in a can of tomato sauce and then keep your fingers crossed. Then there's Burger King's Single Fry. In 2016, fast food giant Burger King's French division announced a new menu item, a carefully wrapped single fry. To accommodate hungry diners, the offering came with three sizes, small, medium, and large. Luckily for French fries lovers, it was just an April Fool's prank. Next article. Sticking with Dogo News again, Pokemon-shaped Hot Cheeto sells for nearly $90,000. This sounds like a prank, but I don't think it is because it's out on TV several days ago. Alvarado Aragon wrote this one. A flamin' hot Cheeto resembling Charizard, the iconic dragon-like Pokemon with wings, has sold for an astounding $87,840. The fire-slash-flying-type Pokemon look-alike named Cheetozard was listed for $250 by Golden Auctions back on February 10th, 2025, after a bidding war that stretched into the early hours of March the 2nd, it sold for $72,000 plus $15,840 in fees. That's a lot of fees to an anonymous buyer. Cheetozard is now the most expensive food item ever sold by Golden. Let's see, who is this? Dave Merriman. He's the head consignment at Golden. He says this, Golden specializes in rare and one-of-a-kind collectibles, and the Cheetozard is exactly this. The art of what makes this item so fun and unique is that it bridges two fandoms, Pokemon and Cheetos. Nobody knows who initially found Cheetozard. However, in 2019, Paul Bartlett, the owner of a collectibles shop in Georgia, saw it on eBay for $500. After some negotiating, he bought the chip for $350. Bartlett stored it in his safe and forgot about it until 2024. Believing Pokemon fans might like it, he posted a short video of the unusual chip on Instagram, and his post quickly went viral. Bartlett wrote in the post, We've had the Cheetozard for about 5 years now, and we totally forgot we had it until cleaning out the safe. Loads of offers have come in. Realizing its value, Bartlett decided to sell it. He found a buyer on eBay willing to pay $10,000. However, the deal fell through because he refused to mail it, and eBay did not allow in-person delivery. In November of 2024, he sold it for the same amount to Arena Club. That's an online trading marketplace. Arena Club later sold it as part of a mystery card pack. The anonymous buyer then took Cheetozard to Golden Auctions for a pop culture auction on February 10th, and the rest, as they say, is history. Unique Cheeto shapes are not unusual. Many even have been dedicated to social media accounts. However, most have little to no financial value and usually get eaten. The one exception is a gorilla-shaped Cheeto that fetched $99,000 in an auction in 2017. Okay, let's move to another publication. Let's do a little National Geographic Kids magazine. They got a thing on Malaysia. I don't know much about Malaysia. I'm going to read this. This Southeast Asian country consists of two regions separated by the South China Sea. Here's some fast facts. The official name, Malaysia. Form of government, a federal constitutional monarchy. The capital is Kuala Lumpur. Population is 32,400,000. The official languages, they just got Malay written there. The money is the ringgit, or the R-I-N-G-G-I-T, ringgit. The area, how big is it? It is 127,355 square miles. Major mountain ranges, you got the Main, the Crocker, the Bintang, the Hoz, and the Aran. Major rivers, the Rajang, the Sagut, the Pahang, and the Klang, went the trolley. Here's the geography of the country of Malaysia. It's two separate areas of land known as a peninsular Malaysia and East Malaysia. The two regions are separated by the South China Sea. I put them all together by about 400 miles. Combined, they would be roughly the size of the state of New Mexico. Peninsular Malaysia is on the tip of Malay Peninsula, a long, thin landmass that snakes out from the country of Thailand toward the South China Sea. East Malaysia stretches across northern Borneo, an island Malaysia shares with the country of Indonesia. Malaysia's capital, Kuala Lumpur, is located on the west side of peninsular Malaysia, closer to the Indonesian island of Sumatra than to East Malaysia. East Malaysia is home to Mount Kinabalu, the country's highest point, which has an elevation of 13,450 feet. Malaysia shares borders with Thailand to the north and Indonesia and the island of Singapore to the south. Singapore is separated from Malaysia by a bridge. And it's crazy stuff here. Nature. Malaysia is blanketed by tropical rainforests. Large rivers fed by nearly 10 feet of rain, yikes, about 3 meters a year, flow from the country's highlands and empty into warm tropical seas. Combined with three ecosystems, forest, river, and marine, they make Malaysia one of the world's 17 mega-diverse countries. A mega-diverse country is one that is home to a majority of Earth's species and has a high number of endemic species or species found only in one location on the planet. Malaysia's tropical rainforests are also home to several endangered species, including Sumatran rhinoceroses, pygmy elephants, and Bornean orangutans in East Malaysia. Malayan tigers and Indo-Chinese leopards prowl the Malay Peninsula. In the South China Sea, several sea turtle species, including the olive ridley, hawksbill green, and leatherback sea turtles, swim in the warm waters. Malaysia has several vast nature reserves and national parks throughout the country. Taman Negara National Park, established in 1938, is the country's oldest national park. Located on the Malay Peninsula, Taman Negara protects one of the world's oldest rainforests, estimated to be more than 130 million years old, and was once home to dinosaurs. Okay, let's head over to Frontiers for Young Minds. This article entitled, Organisms That Create Homes for Other Organisms on Marine Shores. Nicole M. Cameron and Ricardo Scarazzati wrote this article here. The stresses of the intertidal zone. The ocean covers over 70% of the world's surface and includes many different ecosystems. Perhaps one of the most fascinating is the intertidal zone. The intertidal zone is the narrow strip on the shore that is fully covered by seawater at high tide and exposed to the air at low tide. This zone is relatively small compared to other marine environments, but it experiences unique challenges that are not present anywhere else in the world. Twice a day, every day, the tide changes. Therefore, organisms living in the intertidal zone are forced every day to switch from being underwater to being exposed to the air, and vice versa. During low tides, organisms must deal with environmental stresses resulting from being exposed to the air. For example, while water temperatures are relatively moderate, the air can be really hot in the summer or really cold in the winter. Additionally, intertidal creatures can lose a lot of water when they are in direct contact with the air. On the other hand, during high tides, organisms can be eaten by waves, or beaten, I'm sorry, which might damage or even kill them. Finally, intertidal organisms can be eaten, there it is, by land-based predators such as birds and mammals when they are out of the water, and by ocean-based predators such as fish when they are underwater. What is a foundation species? You've been asking yourself all day long. In such a stressful environment, you might expect to find only a few hardy species. However, intertidal zones often have a high biodiversity. Why? One explanation is that many small species find refuge in populations of foundation species. Foundation species are organisms that typically occupy large areas of the substrate, and the three-dimensional structures of their bodies create homes for many small organisms. Think, for example, of the trees in a forest. Trees create habitats for many creatures by increasing the three-dimensional complexity of the habitat and by creating a canopy that protects forest creatures from harsh conditions such as intense sunlight and strong winds. In fact, trees are foundation species. At the intertidal zone, foundation species also create canopies that protect many small organisms from harsh conditions, such as extreme air temperatures and water evaporation during low tides and wave action during high tides. Foundation species can also make it easier for small organisms to survive thanks to small gaps in the understory, where such organisms can hide from large predators. Furthermore, through their complex body structures, foundation species also increase the three-dimensional structure of the habitat and thus create extra spaces where other organisms can live. Organisms can live both on a foundation species itself and in the gaps that the foundation species creates. A coral reef is a good example. In some areas, if corals were not present, the ocean floor would be almost barren and not very habitable for other creatures. However, with corals, there are more spaces to live in and places for small fish to hide, making coral reefs some of the most biodiverse areas in the ocean. Many foundation species live in the intertidal zone and have adapted to thrive in the ever-changing conditions, creating habitats for other creatures and increasing the biodiversity of the community. Meet intertidal foundation species, bivalves, seaweeds, and seagrasses. In that order, bivalves are mollusks that have two shells and often act as foundation species at the intertidal zone. Bivalves include mussels, oysters, and clams, all of which can form extensive clumps of densely packed individuals attached to the intertidal substrate. The small spaces between individual bivalves are safe places for small animals to live, as the shells of the bivalves protect those animals from waves, predators, extreme temperatures, and drying out. The shells can also be an extra substrate, similar to rocks, that small algae and invertebrates can grow on. The close quarters of a dense club of bivalves also trap sediments among the bivalve shells, creating an environment for small burrowing invertebrates. And what would we do without those? This is the second one here. Seaweed, also known as macroalgae, can be foundation species in intertidal habitats. Some red seaweeds, such as Irish moss, are foundation species that live low in the intertidal zone. They live permanently attached to the substrate and produce upright fronds, forming dense clumps where many small organisms can live. Similar to bivalves, the canopies created by these fronds limit temperature extremes by providing shade and retain moisture during low tides, making the habitat more favorable for small organisms. Brown seaweeds, such as knotted wrack, are larger and create a more complex canopy than those red algae. As the fronds of knotted wrack are very flexible, they lay flat on the shore at low tide, providing shade, retaining moisture, and creating more spaces for critters to hide in. Those brown seaweeds also act as an anchor for smaller algae and invertebrates to attach to and grow from. Seagrasses are marine flowering plants that act as foundation species on many sandy, muddy, and rocky shores. Seagrasses, such as eelgrass, have roots that keep sediments in place and thus create areas for burrowing invertebrates. Seagrasses also form canopies that can keep temperatures relatively stable and prevent water loss during low tides. These canopies also keep large predators from accessing intertidal habitats during high tides, making them important nurseries for young fish, for example. Tying it together. Many organisms that live in the stressful intertidal zone rely on one or more foundation species. Bivalves, seaweed, and seagrasses all live on the shore and provide safe places for other small organisms by creating living space that is protected from environmental extremes and predators. Often different kinds of foundation species, each creating homes for different organisms, live near each other, resulting in impressive biodiversity across the whole shore. Unfortunately, foundation species are at risk due to climate change and other human pressures, such as pollution, over-harvesting, and coastal development. Climate change is bringing bigger storms and more extreme temperatures beyond what foundation species can handle. If intertidal foundation species are lost, the diverse communities that call them home will likely be lost too. Fortunately, since foundation species do such a good job at creating homes and maintaining biodiversity, restoring biodiversity in damaged intertidal systems can sometimes be relatively simple. Instead of having to recreate a whole community, reintroducing the foundation species is a good strategy that will naturally draw critters looking for homes and can help rebuild a biodiverse community. Okay, let's go over to Science News Explorers. Bum, bum, this article. It says here, this paleontologist solved a nearly 50-year-old dino mystery. Rebecca Hunt Foster described what is now the state dinosaur of Arkansas. Aaron Tremper wrote this article. It goes a little like this. Paleontologist have unearthed many iconic dinosaurs, such as Tyrannosaurus rex and Triceratops, from the western United States. Relatively few species, however, have popped up east of the Great Plains. Well, back in 2017, Rebecca Hunt Foster described one of these rarities from the 113 million-year-old remains of a right foot. That's where that guy's foot went. Describing a fossil requires making a detailed report on how an extinct animal lived. If it's the first fossil of that species, then this is when it gets its official name. At the time, this dino was the only dinosaur fossil known from Arkansas, says Hunt Foster. Its name is Arkansaurus fridayi. It is now the official state dinosaur of Arkansas. Arkansaurus belonged to a group of dinosaurs called ornithomimids. These agile dinosaurs would have looked similar to today's ostriches, but with long arms instead of wings. Many sported long necks and beaks, which they used to forage for lizards, insects, and eggs. Their legs were also long, allowing them to make speedy getaways from predators. Today, Hunt Foster is the lead paleontologist at Dinosaur National Monument in Jensen, Utah. In this interview, she shares her experiences and advice with Science News Explorers. See, it says here, this interview has been edited for content and readability. Okay, so they ask her, what inspired you to pursue your career? And she says, well, I've always really loved being around animals and in nature. When I was younger, I tried to find a way to combine those two interests into a possible career. My mom is a librarian, and she used to bring books home for me to read. When I was about 12 years old, she brought home a copy of Jack Horner's book, Digging Dinosaurs. Jack Horner is a well-known American paleontologist. I read that one summer, and it just completely captivated me. I was fascinated by the idea that these prehistoric animals had lived on Earth for so long. Having the chance to be out in nature and to excavate them and study how they were preserved just spoke to me. How did you get to where you are today? Well, in high school, I read as many books and as much research as I could. I wrote to paleontologists asking for advice. My parents took me to visit museums. My mom went back to school to earn her master's degree when I was a teenager. That let me visit some campuses and see what it was like to be a college student. It also allowed me to figure out what I was looking for in a program. I ended up enrolling in the geology department at the University of Arkansas. There aren't many dinosaur fossils in Arkansas, so that was a little bit of a disadvantage. But I felt the program gave me a really good background in geology. I had great mentors who helped me find opportunities. What about dinosaurs caught your interest? Well, I worked on everything from billion-year-old algae to more recent animal remains in cave deposits. But there's just something about dinosaurs that is really interesting to me. We don't have any modern representatives other than all our fabulous birds. With dinosaurs, you also don't always find the whole animal. That means you only have bits and pieces to work with, like that right foot of Archosaurus fridayi, or you might only have tracks. It's like trying to complete a puzzle with only half of the pieces in the box. It becomes this cool mystery that takes a lot of work to figure out. Working with dinosaurs is also an interdisciplinary science. It's so fun to work with all sorts of people. What was one challenge that you faced? And how did you get through it? Excuse me, I got a little crazy there. But one challenge that I had is dealing with learning disabilities. I have dyslexia and something called dyscalculia, whatever that is, which is a math learning disability. I'm really bad at transposing numbers, and reading can be somewhat challenging. In high school, I found two ways to cope with it. Learning skills helped me to be successful in what I needed to do. But it was definitely a challenge in college. I'd often struggle to finish timed tests. I found calculus classes challenging, which later impacted my grade point average. That made getting into grad school difficult. I didn't have a 4.0 GPA or do well on standardized tests. I learned things in a very different way than typical learners. I now find that many people, especially in paleontology, learn in different ways. Some people don't find this out until later in life, while others never do. You have to find ways to be successful in your own way. Find others who can help you figure out the solutions you need. Look for people who can get you the extra hours you need on a test. A lot of schools have also done away with standardized tests. That's great because it allowed for a greater diversity of people to succeed in paleontology. Nobody should see these as hurdles to achieving what they want. Okay, next article here on Bigler's World on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sticking with Science News Explorers, this article entitled Dinosaurs Are Still Alive. Today we call them birds. Modern-day feathered flyers are descended from ancient reptiles, says Aaron Tremper, who wrote this article. Across the river from Washington, D.C., sits Potomac Overlook Regional Park. Hiking paths wind through acres of forest and cultivated land. Peer into the thick woods, and you may glimpse a chipmunk or even a deer. And at the visitor center, there are real-life dinosaurs. One of them is Twiggy, sitting on her caretaker's arm. Her massive brown eyes blink in the afternoon sunlight. Ribbons of brown and white streak her chest. This mimics sunlight hitting speckled tree bark. Ah, I see where this is going. Her long black talons squeeze into a leather glove on which she is perched. Who is this talking? Matt Felperin at Nova Parks in Arlington, Virginia. He works as a naturalist, and he says this,
when Twiggy is gripping my glove, I feel every bit of it.
Twiggy will join Felperin and other dinosaurs in his care for a raptor show later in the day. Twiggy is a barred owl. These birds of prey can be found throughout much of eastern North America. Other dinosaurs at the park include Squeaker, the red-shouldered hawk. She chirps as she snacks on mice. We have something in common. And there's pint-sized Smoke, an eastern screech owl. He weighs about as much as a baseball. What is a dinosaur, it says here. When people think dinosaur, oh, this is a quote, says Jingmai O'Connor. When people think dinosaur, what immediately pops up is like a stegosaurus, says Jingmai O'Connor, or something that's just not closely related to birds at all. But for O'Connor and many other researchers, birds are dinosaurs too. At the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, Illinois, O'Connor studies how early birds evolved. Birds are feathered dinosaurs. Oh, this is somebody else named Hans Suess, who is curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Smithsonian Museum of History in Washington, D.C. He says, birds are feathered dinosaurs. Oh, yes. D.C. birds. Birds are a group of subgroup. They live in the suburbs sometimes. They're a subgroup of dinosaurs, which in turn are a type of reptile. Evolutionarily speaking, this makes birds feathered reptiles. Over the past 150 years or so, paleontologists have unearthed this connection through fossils. At first, the idea that birds are dinosaurs ruffled the feathers of the scientific community, but fossils have helped researchers piece together the true origins of birds. There are some of the discoveries that have helped to unveil what makes today's birds so unique. The first bird. Some 150 million years ago, a creature washed into a shallow sea in what is now Germany, about the size of a crow. It sported black wing feathers. Its arms were tipped with claws, and rows of teeth filled its snout. The body churned in a cloud of silt before sinking into the riverbed. Soon its body disappeared completely, buried under layers of fine sediment. This scenario may explain how some fossils of Archaeopteryx formed. Its discovery in 1861 helped scientists first understand the connection between birds and dinosaurs, says Roger Benson. At the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, he studies how reptiles evolved. This is him talking. He says, Archaeopteryx contains a lot of information about what the ancestor of modern birds would have looked like. These fossils showed an animal with flat, asymmetrical wing feathers, similar to today's flying birds. In modern birds, such feathers improve lift and stability during flight. But unlike modern birds, Archaeopteryx sported teeth, clawed wings, and a long, bony tail. They got a picture of the fossil here. It's totally cool. You can see so much. This specimen, it says here, displayed at the museum in Berlin, Germany, is one of 13 known skeletal Archaeopteryx fossils. Discovered in the mid-1870s, the nearly complete fossil includes impressions of well-developed feathers along the animal's wings and tail. The next feathered dinosaur wouldn't be found until over a century later. Back to the article. Researchers quickly noticed this mishmash of reptilian and bird-like features, says Benson. Some use Archaeopteryx to argue that dinosaurs were a stop on the evolutionary tree between reptiles and birds. But there was one key clue in the Archaeopteryx fossil. Unlike other dinosaurs discovered at the time, this one had a wishbone. Reptiles don't have this bone. Modern birds do. Because of this, scientists at the time saw Archaeopteryx as the first bird. Researchers wouldn't find dinosaurs with wishbones, until much later. So at the time, the debate over whether dinosaurs were related to birds fizzled out, says Suze. For the next 60 years or so, scientists thought birds and dinosaurs had no connection at all. Not your typical dinosaur. A 3-meter or 10-foot-long dinosaur stalked across a wide, flat, grassy plain 115 million years ago. This was in what is now Montana. A small mouse-like mammal scurried from a nearby bush. The dinosaur pursued, catching up in a few strides. It pinned its prey with a long sickle claw before tearing it apart with its teeth. Meet Dionysius. Is that Dionysius? I don't know how to pronounce that. The dinosaur wasn't a bird. Instead, it belonged to a group of closely related dinosaurs called Dromaeosaurs. When paleontologist John Ostrom discovered it in the 1960s, it helped to reignite the debate over whether birds and dinos were related. To Ostrom, Dionysius, very much resembled Archaeopteryx. He kept finding more and more unique similarities between this group of meat-eating dinosaurs and early birds. That's Hughes talking. This included wrist bones similar to those in both Archaeopteryx and modern birds. That would have given Dionysius very flexible wrists, an adaptation researchers see as a necessary step towards evolving flight. There were also similarities in the shapes of their hands, pelvises, and feet. Dinocaionymus and other dromaeosaurs belonged to a group of two-legged, mostly meat-eating dinos called theropods. This group also includes Tyrannosaurus rex. Ostrom used his observations of Dionysius as evidence that modern birds descended from theropods. Today, researchers agree that birds arose from small theropods some 160 million years ago. Ostrom's work ushered in renewed interest in how dinosaurs moved and behaved. During this dinosaur renaissance, researchers began moving away from the idea of dinosaurs as sluggish, cold-blooded animals. Some dinosaurs, it appeared, were intelligent and warm-blooded, like today's birds. Still, most paleontologists remain doubtful that modern birds descended from dinosaurs. It would take another 20 years to find evidence that convinced those skeptics. Ruffling feathers. A small dinosaur perched on a branch in a forest some 125 million years ago. The site was what is now northeastern China. The animal yawned. They know all of this. Bristling, long, iridescent black feathers on its arms and legs took on the appearance of four wings. A tree crashed in the distance, causing the dino to leap. Splaying its arms and legs allowed it to glide to the forest floor before bolting into the underbrush. Called Microraptor, this chicken-sized dinosaur was one of many feathered dinosaurs discovered in northeastern China starting in the 1990s. These creatures were crucial to understanding how dinosaurs evolved into birds, says Suze. That's what really pinned it down. These exceptionally preserved fossils have full plumage. The first fossil, here's another one, Sinosauropteryx, had only hair-like fuzz. Found back in 1996, this small meat eater was the first feathered dinosaur found that wasn't closely related to birds. It offered proof that birds inherited feathers from dinosaur ancestors. These early feathers emerged millions of years before those used for flight, says Daniel Kasepka. They may have helped early dinosaurs feel their environment. You know what that means. Kasepska studies bird evolution at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich, Connecticut. Over time, feathers changed in ways that helped dinosaurs and eventually birds keep warm, attract mates, and fly. They got a little thing here. The chicken-sized dinosaur Microraptor lived some 35 million years after the first birds appeared. But his discovery in the early 2000s helped confirm that birds evolved from small feathered dinosaurs. And then it says researchers are still working to learn how well this dino could take to the air. Okay, this is Kasepka talking. How does he sound? He sounds like this. When Microraptor was first discovered, it was very unique. That's because this dinosaur had wing feathers growing from its legs. Some people called them trousers, which I think is hilarious, he says. Researchers suspected the four wings worked together to help the dino fly like a biplane. Researchers soon started finding these trousers in early birds, dromaeosaurs, and other closely related dinosaurs. Among these were names that I can't pronounce, Anacrinornis and Xiaotingia, which lived about 10 million years before Archaeopteryx. At one time, researchers suspected that these two were among the first birds. That's more likely, though. They were just close cousins to the ancestors of true birds. But the earliest birds in the Jurassic period would have probably looked very similar, says Hughes. I forget what Hughes sounds like. Oh, yeah, I think of the ones in Jurassic Park, shrunk down to the size of a crow or a pigeon, and then put feathers on them. Okay, I'll wait. O'Connor and her team have been studying these feathers to see how flight might have evolved. They examined the wing feathers of 346 living bird species and found a consistent set of rules for birds that could fly. All birds capable of powered flight had 9 to 11 feathers. These outermost feathers are attached to a bird's fused hand bones. Yikes. These feathers are also asymmetrical or uneven in shape. In modern birds, this helps generate lift. Her team then examined fossils from 35 species of non-bird dinosaurs and early birds. Says O'Connor, the preservation is good enough that you can actually measure things like asymmetry or actually count the number of feathers. The scientists found that Archaeopteryx and Microraptor seemed capable of flight. Other bird-like dinosaurs did not. Anacrinornis, once a contender for the first bird, had about 20 primary feathers. They were also relatively symmetrical, says O'Connor. It's a very high number, clearly different from the 9 to 11 that you see in flying birds. This work is a step towards studying how flight evolved using numbers, says O'Connor. This is just a problem in paleontology where basically the past 150 years of research was qualitative. That means making observations that are hard to precisely measure or analyze using data. Many hypotheses made from observing fossils haven't yet been tested, she says. Now that's finally happening. Snoozing dinos. About 70 million years ago, a flash rainstorm arrived in what is now Asia's Gobi Desert. In a sandy burrow, a small dinosaur tucked in its long legs under its body, resting its head on its right knee. Oh, that's just cute. Its fuzzy tail curled around its body. Soon the dinosaur was fast asleep. Rain steadily gathered above the burrow, causing the sands to shift. Suddenly, the sand loosened, burying the dinosaur as it slept. Bum, bum. This is probably how the theropod, see if I can pronounce this, Jaculinicus. That's as far as I'm going to go. That's how this dinosaur died, says Kota Kubo. He studies theropods at the University of Tokyo in Japan. Jaculinicus belonged to a group of theropods called, another word here, alvarezosaurs. Something like that. These small dinosaurs had long legs, stubby arms, ending in a single claw. Kubo discovered the nearly complete skeleton of one during a 2016 excavation in Mongolia. The team described their findings in 2023 in Plus One. The fossils showed a meter or 3 foot long dinosaur preserved in a position similar to the way modern birds sleep. Kubo's team suspect the pose helped smaller dinosaurs conserve heat. The first such slumbering dino was found back in 2004. It belonged to Mi Long, a dinosaur even more closely related to birds than Jaculinicus. Let's see, who is this Benson? Forget what Benson sounds like. He sounds like the
very rarely we get dinosaurs that are preserved in their life position.
That's somebody named Benson. Most fossils get jumbled over time, but some skeletons revealed complex behavior, such as brooding over eggs. These remains have shown that
when theropod dinosaurs do those behaviors, their postures are really bird-like,
he says. These remains add evidence that the birds inherited these behaviors from dinosaurs. In the past, such bird behaviors weren't viewed as bird-like. In 1923, paleontologists found another Mongolian dinosaur lying directly over a nest containing eggs. The team suspected that the beaked dinosaur died while stealing eggs. So they called the creature Oviraptor, or egg thief. But in the 1990s, researchers began finding related dinosaurs in similar positions. That led scientists to assert that these were probably mother dinosaurs brooding over their eggs. Such findings suggest that some non-bird dinosaurs used their body heat to keep eggs warm, says O'Connor. Such parental care is something that is seen in modern birds, but not in other modern reptiles. New threats. Back at the Potomac Overlook Regional Park, Tiger, the great horned owl, rests on a perch in his enclosure. He looks typical for his species. Two ear-like tufts of feathers sprout from his head. Fluffy, cream-colored feet poke out from the cover of his mottled brown and gray wings. But a lamented sign next to his exhibit points out something else, his missing eye. Over 20 years ago, a car struck Tiger in Virginia. This damaged an eye that was eventually removed. Unlike Smoke or Twiggy, Tiger is too flighty to come with Falperin to raptor shows, says Falperin. He's a skittish and nervous bird because he can't see. Raptors often hunt alongside roads, he notes. Food tossed out from vehicles attracts rodents, which attracts birds. A lot of people who are throwing out this food waste think it's harmless because it's biodegradable stuff, says Falperin, but it's not. Many of the birds we recognize today emerged quickly after the extinction event 66 million years ago that killed off non-bird dinosaurs, says Kasepka. Most modern bird groups were around by about 50 million years ago, some even sooner, says Kasepka. We have 62 million-year-old penguins. These diving birds lived in what is now New Zealand, a mere 4 million years after the asteroid impact. And they're like totally flightless, flippered birds already. That's so quick, says O'Connor. Birds are one of evolution's great success stories. More than 11,000 species exist today. While many fly, others evolved ways to navigate our world. Emus, ostriches, cassowaries, and kiwis dart through forests and grasslands on strong legs. Penguins dive into dangerous oceans after prey. But now human activities threaten birds around the world. Researchers and citizen scientists alike are working to conserve important habitats, that is, that birds need to thrive. The traits that make birds unique came from ancient reptiles. They've helped make some of the most resilient animals to have lived on Earth, says O'Connor. We are so used to thinking that dinosaurs are extinct and they're part of Earth's long past history. But actually, dinosaurs are the most successful group of land vertebrates on our planet today. Okay, next up here. On Bigler's World, switching over to another publication. Let's do a little news for kids. Newsforkids.net. Iceberg breaks free, reveals surprising sea life. Antarctica, bum bum. In January, an iceberg as large as Chicago separated from an ice shelf in Antarctica. By chance, a scientific research ship was nearby. The scientists jumped at the chance to study an area of the ocean floor that had been covered by ice for thousands of years. What they found surprised them. Okay, the Falkor 2, says parentheses 2 as in T-O-O, is a research ship that belongs to the Schmidt Ocean Institute. The ship was already in Antarctica when the scientists aboard learned about the iceberg breaking off. The researchers quickly decided to drop what they were doing and go study the 209-square-mile area of the seafloor below where the iceberg used to be. Icebergs are so thick that it's extremely difficult to study what's beneath them. This was a rare chance to explore an area of the seafloor that had been cut off by ice for a very long time. The researchers were curious to see what, if anything, might have existed in the dark waters below the ice. Sunlight is normally the main source of energy for life in the sea. In open oceans, important food supplies fall slowly towards the bottom, even where it's dark. But the thick ice meant no food supplies could fall beneath it. And since the ice had blocked out the light for thousands of years, the scientists weren't expecting to find much life. But they were in for a surprise. Using the ship's remote-controlled underwater vehicle, the team explored the seafloor in the area for 8 days. Even though the area had been in the dark for so long, the team discovered a rich and active variety of sea life. Who is this? Patricia Esquette. She's one of the chief scientists on the ship, and she says, "Hour by hour and day by day, we kept seeing more." Not only did they see fish and squid, they found giant sea spiders and octopuses, as well as corals and sponges. The scientists believe that some of the species they found have never been seen before. The researchers took pictures and videos of the sea life they found and also collected a few samples. The scientists also pushed long tubes into the ocean floor to collect samples of dirt and rock. The layers in these tubes should give the researchers more information about the creatures that have lived in the area and how the sea floor has changed over time. Scientists are very interested in how such a wide variety of sea life could exist in such a dark, cold place. They suspect that food sources may have been swept under the iceberg by ocean currents. For that reason, they also had the undersea vehicle investigate the movement of the water deep undersea. One especially interesting question is how the life in this area will change in the future, now that the seafloor is no longer hidden beneath the ice and light can reach it. That information could become more important as global warming leads to more melting of ice shelves and more icebergs break free. Next article. Sticking with news for kids, Mia DuPont, youngest female master scuba diver, East Greenwich, Rhode Island. It took 2 years of training and effort, but in February, Mia DuPont finally reached her goal of becoming a master scuba diver. The 12-year-old is now the youngest female in the U.S. to ever earn that title, which represents a level of training that most divers, even adults, never reach. Diving underwater is exciting, but there are many ways in which it can be dangerous. So organizations like PADI, PADI, they offer training courses to make sure divers can enjoy themselves safely underwater. Most divers only get the basic level of training, open water diver. When Mia DuPont was young, she learned that her mother had become an open water diver when she was still in high school. Mia decided that she wanted to become a diver too, but the youngest you can start training as a diver is 10 years old. Starting on her 10th birthday, Mia got serious. First, she got her open water diver's certificate. Mia lives in Rhode Island, where the oceans are cold and you usually can't see very far, but she didn't let that stop her. No. Mia formed a tight bond with her diving teachers, who were impressed with her energy and drive. Let's see, who is this? Seamus Hastings, one of her instructors, says, she sets her mind to something and she gets it done. Oh, yeah, she does. Over the next 2 years, Mia kept working at it. PADI courses involve diving practice, but they often include more normal class work, too, including studying and tests. Mia took several other courses where she learned different skills, including first aid, how to find her way underwater, and how to identify fish. When you're diving, you should always have a buddy, a second person, working with you as you dive. Mia's mother decided to take all the courses Mia was taking, so when Mia goes diving, her mom is her buddy. Mia has now logged 78 dives, far more than the 50 needed to become a master scuba diver. But Mia had to wait for her last two courses, Advanced Open Water Diver and Rescue Diver. That's because you have to be at least 12 years old to earn those certificates. In February, Mia and her family traveled to Mexico, where she made her first night dive. Over the next week, Mia did most of the training required for the last two courses. On her birthday, she passed the Advanced Open Water course. The next day, when she was officially 12, Mia finished the Rescue Diver course. That was challenging. Mia did three dives in one day, including one deep dive down to 58 feet below the surface. The hard part of the course was showing that she could raise an injured adult diver to the surface and take the steps needed to help them breathe again. Mia says she feels proud to have become a master scuba diver, but she doesn't plan to stop there. Oh, no, no, no. She's interested in getting more training as a diver. In the future, she hopes to become a marine biologist. She's particularly interested in tagging and tracking sharks.
New.
Says here, did you know the first person in the U.S. to become a master scuba diver at the age of 12 was Mateo Miller of Florida? He set his record last August. And we got time for one quick article here. Massive earthquake hits Myanmar. On Friday, Myanmar was hit by a strong earthquake that killed over 2,000 people and injured close to 4,000 others. The quake has caused massive damage, and efforts to help those affected are being slowed by the effects of the earthquake and the country's ongoing civil war. The 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck near Mandalay, Myanmar's second largest city. The earthquake, which hit in the early afternoon, was the most powerful quake to hit the country since 1912. Over 160 aftershocks followed the main quake, including one with a magnitude of 6.7. The quake caused buildings to collapse and bridges to fall. It damaged roads all through the area. The country's capital, there's another word I can't pronounce, Naypyidaw, is roughly 125 miles away. It was also hit hard. The earthquake was felt as far away as Thailand and southwest China. In Thailand, at least one building collapsed and 19 people were killed. In Myanmar, over 2,000 people have died and 270 have been reported missing. But there is limited communication with the areas most affected. The United Nations says the number of deaths is very likely to increase as time goes on. One of the big problems has been the lack of heavy equipment. Many buildings have collapsed, and rescue workers are trying to find survivors. But without heavy equipment to remove the rubble, in many areas, rescue workers have had to do the best they can with just their bare hands. The country's damaged roads have made it hard to bring in the needed equipment. With close to 4,000 people injured, the need for doctors, nurses, and medical supplies is high. The WHO, as in, the World Health Organization, I guess, says three hospitals in the area have been destroyed and 22 others have been damaged. The widespread damage to roads, bridges, and even airports has made it very difficult for aid to get into the country and to the areas where it is needed. Myanmar's military has said it will accept help from other countries. Many countries, including China, Russia, and India, have sent rescue workers and supplies. But the continued fighting has made it harder for aid organizations to help. Some groups are also worried that the government might limit aid going into areas controlled by forces that oppose the government. The government announced a week of mourning for the victims of the earthquake. And at the bottom of the article, it's got a "Did you know?" The U.S. has promised Myanmar $2 million in aid, but the U.S. programs that would normally have helped in a situation like this were ended weeks ago when U.S. President Donald Trump moved to shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. With that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.